On episode 204 of the Happy Market Research Podcast, I'm interviewing Joaquim Brecha, president of SMR. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by G3 Translate. The G3 Translate team offers unparalleled expertise in foreign language translations for market researchers and insight professionals across the globe. Not only do they speak hundreds of languages, they are fluent in market research. For more information, please visit them at g3translate.com. That's the letter G, the number 3, translate.com. Hi, I'm Jamin Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. My guest today is Joaquim Brecha, International Director at NetQuest. NetQuest is a quantitative technology platform with self-reported and digital behavioral tracking, providing customer insights in 23 countries. Additionally, Joaquim is the recently elected SMR president. He's the advisor to MindProber, co-founder of NGO Health US Nepal, and speaker. Joaquim, thank you very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Thank you, Jamin. It is my pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about where you grew up.
Good. I was born in Barcelona, and I was born in the late years of the Franco's dictatorship. At the time, Barcelona was not the brilliant city that we know today. You must know that the Spanish Civil War in the 30s and ulterior 40 years of dictatorship dramatically cut the evolution of the traditionally prosperous Barcelona. And very importantly, it shaped the mentality, and it became an endogamic mentality with a complex of inferiority towards Europe. But I was fortunate, and I was born in a family that had overcome this closing of borders, both mental and physical. For instance, my mother, at the age of 18, she went to UK as a babysitter, and she learned English when almost nobody spoke English at the time in Spain. Oh, my father, who is a doctor in engineering, after studies, he went to Norway as a stage. So I was fortunate to be born in a family that always had this international approach. And indeed, I was conceived in France. My father was working for a Belgian multinational company, and he was expatriated in France. And I was conceived there, although born in Barcelona, and they moved back to France, where I spent my first 2 years of my life. It's not that my French was from that period, I guess not, because then I had to study, but it definitely created a mental framework for the family. So I can say that my childhood was a happy childhood in a large, educated family that never transmitted to us this complex of inferiority that was among the Spaniards when looking at Europe, at that time, Western Europe. So in parallel, I was a very curious boy. I loved to read everything I could, being Asterix and Obelix and Tintin, my favorite comics. And I can tell that at the age of 14, I had my first interchange with a French family. So the French guy came to my house and I went to his in Paris and Normandy. I did the same at 17 with a guy from Connecticut. So he came to our home and I went to Connecticut for a month. And this is something that all my two other brothers also had. So I was fortunate enough to have these exchanges and this framework as a family. And as a teenager, I witnessed the entrance of Spain in the European Union in 1986, and this was a total transformation of the country and society. Suddenly, we got connected to the European market, and the European trends started to reach us at a similar pace as the rest of European countries. And indeed, the gap of products that we could find in our supermarkets compared to the ones that I could find in our neighbor, France, started to diminish. So it meant that we were getting closer to Europe. At that time, Spain was booming and the country was receiving lots of investment, but the fall of the Berlin Wall occurred, and then suddenly Spain was not as attractive as it was during those years. So, however, Spain had already been connected to Europe and it really changed the mentality. More concretely, or more particularly in 1992, Barcelona held the Olympic Games and it was a success. It really transformed the city. And me being in my early 20s, it was also a nice way of looking at the world and I'm becoming proud of where we were living and what we were doing in Barcelona. And it completely changed the mentality of my city and my country. We became international, completely international. So I don't know if this gives you a context of my childhood and where I was growing up.
I know that you are, and we talked about this a little bit at the beginning of the podcast, you are connected with Catalan, right?
Yeah, I'm Catalan, yeah.
And there's a lot relative to the uniqueness of that culture in the context of the larger EU. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's like and how that shaped your worldview?
Of course, I cannot get into politics, but just getting into cultural aspect. So we have our own language and our own culture. And of course, it's a little one. So we are, Catalan is spoken or understood by, let's say, 9 million people. And so it's a small language, but very active, and it has been preserved throughout many years, and culturally very active in all sorts of cultural fields. And so it has given me the opportunity of looking at the world from, let's say, not from a very strong and dominant culture, but from a little culture that is fighting for his perseverance and striving in this multi-diverse and multicultural world to be there on the stage. So it gives me a sensitiveness to all sorts of realities. I'm not looking at the world from a very dominant perspective, but from a way that I try to understand the culture of others, how others look at the world, and try to understand their position. So that's why I love to be in contact with people coming from very strong cultures or very dominant countries and languages, as well as with all sorts of other from other origins.
Yeah, at this point, I really want to pull this out because in a lot of ways, this is relevant to market research today. You know, market research as, I'm not sure, I hear lots of different numbers between $40 and $70 billion, but we know as an industry has been not growing in line with, at least not growing in line with GDPs.
No, actually, the last ESOMAR report states that what we understand as traditional market research accounts for $45 billion. And if we enlarge the view and we get into the new scope of market research, it can be like $75 billion.
And so then, you know, you broaden that to the utilization of consumer insights, which has just completely blown up, right, over the last decade. Everyone from the intern to the CEO is conducting a survey, or at least it seems that way, given the democratization of access to the consumers through different tools like SurveyMonkey or what have you. So market research in a lot of ways is this very large industry and important industry, and yet we have to have that humble or that view of the marketplace at large to understand how we can fit in and empower and ensure that business decisions, you know, are being informed in a correct way.
Yeah, this is, I would say, if not the biggest, one of the biggest challenges we are facing now in bringing this voice of people, voice of the customer, in a proper way to the table and being conducted with the right methodologies and the rigor that it merits.
So in 2000, you joined TNS as the retail services director. How in the world did you wind up in market research?
Yeah, I think I will join some of the answers you have got so far. I guess I fell into market research by natural fall. Since very young, I was always interested in society, in politics, in geography. I was always interested in understanding the world and people. I've always been fascinating in learning new things and learning things about societies. This is why I studied economics, led by this passion. In university, I was much involved in a student association called ISEC. So it was a unique international association for the students of economics. And I started to get involved into promoting international understanding, education, organizing conferences, and attending international conferences. So this moved me to my first job. I was hired by the largest FMCG Spanish association, and I was responsible to organize seminars, conferences, to take Spanish managers to visit retailers in Europe and the US to learn from those countries how retail was evolving and the consumer patterns were evolving. So I became an expert in retail and the consumer understanding. Then I was, from this expertise, I was hired by Carrefour, the big retailer, to create the first category management department in Carrefour supermarkets. I stayed there for 2 years, and there was a merger. I had to be moved to Madrid. I spent there some time. I had been married with who is currently my wife, and I didn't like the outcome of the new company. So that's when, you know, the TNS came, and they were looking for a research, for a retailer specialist. And I had been in touch with them before. When I was at this first job I was mentioning, I was also purchasing research, and I had a relationship with them. And I was, as I told, I was always interested in trends in society, in consumer. And I was coming from being a retailer, so I thought it was a nice move. And I got into TNS as the expert in retail and shopper.
What was one of the more difficult or interesting, I should say, one of the more interesting transitions moving into research for you?
Now, when I recall it, because I did this move twice, I did it again later. I think the transition was at the first moment was to cross the bridge from being a purchaser and the one that has the power and that has the money, because I was a retailer, so I was responsible for negotiating with the manufacturers, and I was the one that was deciding what product was being sold on the shelves, and you know all this negotiation behind. So suddenly I crossed the bridge and became a provider. And at that moment, I don't know if now it's the same, but at that moment, it was an important change. Being a provider or being a client, that is an important difference. So I remember when I was a client, I could take the phone, call whoever it was, and they would just show up in my office. And when I was a client, I was taking the phone and trying to get those meetings and get relevant and get relevant to clients. So that's a difference. That's an important difference at the moment. Yeah. But then on exchange of that, I could get immersed into knowledge. So when I was at the retailer, it was a lot of management and Excel spreadsheets are analyzing revenues and profits and ROI and negotiating everything. And then I could do the same, but understanding consumer, understanding from the, at that moment, TNS World Panel data, so the consumption trends and so on. And then what I really got in love to was storytelling. I have discovered throughout the years that I'm a good storyteller. So I discovered that, and I became a quite successful presenter in conferences and speaker. And yeah, I really enjoyed that way of building stories with data.
Storytelling has been, I have been reflecting on this. I'm going to be writing a post, trends that will continue to gain momentum in 2019, both from a technology perspective and also as a skill set perspective. And one of those trends that I've been picking up on from our guests and just observational in the marketplace is storytelling as a skill, in the same way that math is a skill.
It's fundamental, but it's not just today. I mean, it comes from the most ancient times. When you see the paintings in the caves, those people that were painting those buffaloes or those deers, they were storytelling. They were telling stories to their friends and families in the cave. So it's been forever and will be forever. We humans need the storytelling.
I like that analogy. I've never heard anybody put it exactly like that before. And of course, I'm thinking to myself, that's like the old school whiteboarding.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, here's the, yeah, it could be. But it, I mean, all of us. I mean, indeed, when you talk with your grandparents or older people or younger people, everybody likes to listen to a story, and then you see that you reach much better to their insight.
How do you feel? Do you feel like we're as an industry treating storytelling as more of a skill that is learnable and also sellable versus how we've done it historically?
I think we have to look at the origins of market research. I think we have been not that good in showing off our skills, our capabilities, our strengths. And some of the people that were good at that, for instance, consultants, they have very easily taken the stage on behalf of us. Where we have the knowledge, and we have the data, and we have the right people that know how to answer the appropriate questions and join the dots with the data. So we have all the inputs to be the best storytellers. The best storytellers in the world, because we have the information and we know how to analyze and make sense of that information. So we can be the best storytellers. So from one side, yes, I agree. It's a learnable skill, but also it comes from your DNA. I mean, there are some people that are given and some people that are not so given. But we have to push people because I think everybody is capable of tell stories. Some will be more graceful, some other will be less, but everybody's capable of telling a story with sense and purpose. So I think we have to be less shy and let our creativity flow with the inputs we have.
Mm, beautiful. So NetQuest has seen, I mean, I've been following NetQuest really since you guys started, or since the company started. You've seen steady growth over the years that you've been part of it, and obviously before as well. What are two keys of success that other executives and companies can learn from?
Okay, I could mention many. And of course, I was not the founder of the company, so I could mention many related to the founder of the company. I joined in 2009, so it's 9 years already. So I've seen all the expansion, and I've been part of this expansion during the last 9 years. So I would pick two key points. One is the values and purpose, and the other one is perseverance. Values and purpose, we have defined our mission as a mission that we want to create a mirror of society for society and promote values accordingly. And these values give us guidelines to behave in our daily basis, and particularly when critical decisions arrive, it's when values have a purpose. When particular decisions arrive that you can go one side or the other side, is when you set the value, say, no, we have this value, we have to be coherent and consistent, so let's keep the decision within or accordingly to the value. So we have all these values set in place, and it's a kind of common culture. And secondly, perseverance. NetQuest has been a pioneer. I mean, he was born here in Barcelona when the Spanish market was not prepared. So it was created in 2001 as a survey platform for the Spanish market, as online survey platform. It took some time to make it work. It was not an easy path. In 2005, NetQuest creates the first digital access panel, and it was launched in a moment in which the Spanish market was not ready for that. All the questions arose and all the questions and difficulties were there. But it's a perseverant company. And in the end, we became the clear leaders of the market. And it allowed us to expand to first to LATAM and more lately to some other countries like the US. For instance, we have been evangelizing on the online methodology for many years when these markets were not mature, like the Spanish market or the Latin market. Many, many years investing in evangelizing and showing how it can be done. We were also the first ones in getting the ISO quality stamp when dealing with samples. So even before, much before the GDPR and the strict rules regarding how to treat people, we already knew that we had to treat people with transparency and fairness in the reward system. Or most recently, when in 2014, NetQuest acquired the Dutch company Wakupa, which is a company that develops a software by which we can track what people do online and mobile, of course, with their consent. And this is the secret of the panel, always the consent and the good information of what they are doing with us. And during these last 4 years, we have as well been evangelizing on the digital passive measurement, publishing papers, use cases, handbooks, or presenting at conferences in America, Europe, APAC. I personally have presented in North America, LATAM, Europe, and APAC different cases of how we can track digital behavior of people and how it can be very beneficial for companies to understand the digital space. So yeah, values, I would say values and perseverance in the mission that we have.
Yeah, the values and you know the word I like there is this mirror. So the view back on the person and then understanding if, you know, they're a good fit is absolutely critical. How have you applied that to your new role, or how will you apply that to your new role at SMR?
Well, for me, values are very important, and I'm very glad that most lately, ethics has come at the front of every discussion. And it's been also pushed by legislation in a way. But today, in this big data world, I'm happy to see that more and more people are demanding to create an ethics framework to deal with the information and to deal with what we people give to the big data. So aligned with the legislation and this demand, for me, values and ethics are a must. And it's something that as professionals, we have to understand, because it's the way we can have credibility in front of the stakeholders that we relate to. So as professionals, as market researchers, ethics must be our main, let's say, main asset to start with.
Yeah, so kind of piggybacking on your 2 points, purpose and perseverance. You know, perseverance, anytime someone says that word, I think about Ernest, I believe his last name is Shackleton. Ernest Shackleton is a fairly well-known historical figure. He was a captain of a ship. And so anyway, his family crest was, "We conquer through perseverance." I think I'm getting that right. And that has stuck with me. I've heard this, I don't know, whatever, maybe 2 decades ago now, but that has stuck with me through my life. And you know, it's interesting. A lot of people, I believe, they give up before they get the payday. And I don't necessarily mean the payday in a monetary way. It could be just emotional or, you know, investment with family and friends, thinking it's about the long game, right? That where you have to play towards, not about, not at a play by play. I mean, obviously we continuing the analogy, you know, when we're in the trenches or when we're playing the game, whatever it is, every play is important. It moves us down the field, but we have to understand we're going to lose some. It's about how we consistently show up and then execute every day, year after year, not just week after week, that it winds up putting us in a dominant position.
Yeah, but this is always a difficult moment to assess whether you have to persevere, you have to stop and change your activity. It's always difficult to know what's the right point, but it's true. Perseverance is very important. By the way, sorry, I just checked on Google and it's endurance, not endeavor.
The Shackleton. Ah, there it is, endurance. Yeah. That's right, endurance. That's right, that was the name of his ship.
Yeah.
But then having that view of perseverance, all of a sudden it starts informing your purpose and tying that back to, you know, you guys pioneering the ISO certification, which is really important to take the time out. That's not something that's just like easy off the shelf, or you don't just write a check. There's a lot of effort, that time and treasure that's involved in that certification, especially I'd imagine in the early days, and being willing to make that investment, because a lot of times there isn't a direct ROI that's measurable in the first quarter, right? Of that, you're thinking about, okay, I'm going to make this investment and that's going to pay off over the next 5 years as we differentiate ourselves in the market of having this certification and proving that, you know, we're putting our money where our mouth is, and we are quality and a brand that you can trust.
Well, here there's a couple of lessons. One is that because NetQuest was in a not as mature market, for instance, the US or UK, the online methodology took more time to be developed. So, for instance, maybe in the US and UK, it was much faster to get nice money from scratch when offering a sample, online sample. So those companies were making money, so they were very, very fast in developing, whereas NetQuest had a very slow pace. So it helped the management and the founder to think very well what he wanted as an offer and how he wanted to build this offer. So it resulted that when, for instance, we had to do this ISO quality audit, most of the things that were required, we had already them in place. So our adaption was minimal because the bar had been set so high that we already had almost everything. And it's been the same for the GDPR. Our transformation into being GDPR compliant has been very easy because we were already there. We have been very consistent in keeping the bar highest possible in terms of sample recruitment, sample treatment, and sample quality.
All right. So you have a lot going on. I think our listeners picked that up on the intro, right? So you were a council person at SMR prior to your recent election as president, advisor to Mindprober, co-founder of NGO Health US Nepal, which is actually, I mean, we should probably just pull out really quick here and talk about your work there in Nepal. What is Health US?
Health Us Nepal. Yeah,
I keep saying US. I apologize. Us.
No, it's exactly what I said when we were branding the NGO. We're branding that. I said, look, this can be confusing, and everybody said, no, don't worry. I said, okay, now we have the proof. Well, to tell a long story short, so I have this cousin that was born in Nepal. He was adopted by one of my uncles. And he came to not Barcelona, but a town near Barcelona. He has become a doctor. And at the age of 18, he asked, even before, he asked his parents to get back to Nepal and meet his original family because he knew he had been not stolen, but he was taken from his town by the rich guy of the town. And he had the sense that his family didn't know that he was not there. And effectively, he went with his parents to Nepal at the age of 18, and he met his father that was still living, and his sisters and brothers, and it was a shock. So he was determined to study medicine. So now he's a doctor. And once he finished the medicine, last year he had been in this town, which is the most remote area of Nepal, the poorest one, every summer. And he has been saving money. He goes there and he has been contributing to his original population or original village and area. So 1 year ago, one year and a half ago, I was here at NetQuest working, and suddenly I received an email from him. It was sent to the whole family. It's a big family. My mother's family, it's a big family composed by the brothers and sisters and all their descendants. So, and we are very, very tight family. So we are very linked. So he sends this email saying, hey, I have opened up this solidarity fundraising campaign. Could you help? So I call him, say, what are you doing? And he explains me, and I told him, look, we need to formalize it. We need to make it legal. We need to create a structure on that because, I mean, I love what you want to do, but if you just go on a open fundraising page, I think this will not be that trustable. So we need to create something that can be trustable. So we did that. It was in summer 2017. We created the NGO, so it's his father, one of his best friend that has also a sister that had been adopted from Nepal, and myself who are running the association, and we started to get members. So far, we have created the first, let's say, modern pharmacy in the region. I remember that it's the most poor and remote region in Nepal. So my cousin is there. He's treating an average of 40 people per day. He travels on foot because there are no such ways. You cannot have a car, you cannot have a motorbike. He has to go on foot. And so he travels a perimeter of 60 kilometers, giving service to all villages. And we have set up a team. So it's a pharmacy that we're selling the, all the medicines. We're getting money here, here in Spain, and but it's open to the world. So I open up the opportunity to for people to donate at any part of the world.
I'm just going to mention it, and we will include a link to the website in the show notes.
Oh, thank you. And it's very nice because, have you seen the movie Lion, this Indian guy? Have you seen that movie, Lion?
No, I've not.
So it's an Indian guy that also it's adopted in Australia, and finally he discovers his past because he can relate to some memories, and he discovers where he comes from. When he was telling the story, I said, "Look, Mark, you are like the lion, the Catalan lion. It's the same. We have discovered your origins, and now you are going there back, which is very hard. I can tell you. He's a doctor here in Barcelona, in the Barcelona region, in Catalonia, and he has decided to be there. And where people in Kathmandu, doctors in Kathmandu, do not want to go there because life there is very hard. He has decided to settle there and help the community, and he's training people to help people. So it's very, very nice. And even I have involved my kids as well in that initiative. And for instance, every time that he has been here and we have gone to an interview in a television, a newspaper, radio, I bring my kids as well. And yesterday, for instance, the largest radio and newspaper in Catalonia published a piece of news about that. And it was nice because yesterday night I was with my elder kid and I show him and he said, "Wow, we did it." Like it was
ownership. I love that.
Yeah, we did it.
What a great view to be able to offer your children, just creating an attitude of gratefulness and thankfulness.
Yeah.
Right. Of, you know, we are where we are and we have the opportunity to help and contribute. But I mean, at the end of the day, there's no, you know, the roles, the lives could have completely been shifted, right, on the other way. And I don't want to get too much into the whole, like, philosophy or turn this into a weird conversation. But, you know, it as soon as we can pick our heads up and look at the rest of the world, we can really reframe our problems and our struggles in a much more positive way, I believe.
Yes. We play another league, and you play in California, you play another league that I play, and these countries play another league, yeah.
So with all the things going on, what was your motivation for running for president of SMR?
Okay, that's a nice question. Well, running for president has been the evolution of my past 4 years as an SMR council member. I've been engaged. I have been participating in different activities. I have contributed to this promotion, so I have been feeling part of the team. And you know that when you better know an organization that is well run, that is good, you feel more in love and you feel more engaged. So I think it was a natural step for me to do because I was very much involved and I believe in the cause. I would say that maybe the right question would be, what decided me to get in 2014 to the council as first time? Because I must admit that at that moment I didn't have such a clear idea of what I was enrolling to. I mean, at that moment, it was nice. I was participating at the SMR events and I was active there, but I didn't really know much more about than that. So it took me 1 year to understand the implications of what SMR activity is, the stakeholders, the variety of memberships, and the real role. So it took me some time. But once I learned that, I've been very much engaged, and I'm a great promoter of SMR. As I was saying, I believe in what SMR is doing. I believe that it does what it does for the good of our profession and our industry. I even say that if SMR did not exist, it should have to be invented. It should have to be created. I have been traveling during these last 4 years across the market research world. I've been in many markets and I was feeling mature. I was feeling mature to contribute. I was feeling mature to contribute with my vision, my experience, my knowledge, my networking, my energy. So I felt it was a time, the appropriate time. And as I see that you appreciate very much the personal touch, I can tell you that running for an international position like this one is a life changer experience. I can tell you, I have changed some things inside me thanks to the process of running for this kind of election. So it's an experience that I fully recommend to everybody that can have an interest to service such an association.
So obviously you have a service-oriented heart, hence the work with Nepal, Help Us Nepal. Mm-hmm. But what would you see as one of the biggest learnings entering into this role? I'm actually citing here a YouTube interview that you had where you said, "The surprise I got once in council was how many things you don't know."
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting, for me, that's super interesting because, I mean, listen, we've been doing this for a lot of years, right? And we've talked to a lot of people. We have a pretty wide view of the space.
Yeah, but in the end, you are focused on your activity and you have some objectives to attain and you have budgets and you have this pressure. And suddenly you get into an open space where there are many, many different stakeholders, many different actors, and you start to learn from them. But most precisely, as I was telling before, I knew SOMR mainly by the events and publications and all this public sphere. And then I realized that the cornerstone of SOMR is its extraordinary capability of moving the professionals of the industry to self-regulate, to create guidelines, and to stay ahead of legislation because we want to be better than what is expected from us. And for instance, I can tell you, last week we were in Amsterdam and we had this meeting that there was the current council plus the new council. And it's very nice because when you see how the new members start to get the information that we are dealing with and this sort of stuff that we are discussing, all of them, they are surprised, like, wow, I didn't know that the SOMR was doing as much and so many things and so important, for instance, like all the legislation aspect. SOMR has had a key contribution in the GDPR law. The way it was drafted, it could be very harmful for the market research industry and market research companies. And SOMR has played a key role in preserving our activity in Europe, but also globally, because the GDPR law is an inspiration for many other countries. And SOMR is very pays much attention to all these moves that the legislation is having across the world. And the learnings that we're having in Europe can perfectly be transmitted to the rest of the countries and the world. And it's something we want to do because we must teach the legislator what we are doing. We have to tell them that what we are doing is for a good purpose, that we're very conscious of the value of the information that we are managing, and that we have to manage it in an ethic way and preserving all the standards. So SOMR is doing an exceptional role in teaching the legislator in the favor and the benefit of our activity. So this one, you know, kind of iceberg. You know SOMR by the events and publications, and then you get deeper, and suddenly you start to discover a whole new world and say, wow, if there was not these people doing that, somebody should do that because it's necessary.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, applying storytelling, you know, mastercrafted storytelling on top of this activity would be something that would help the whole industry at large understand actual ramifications of, to your point, you know, GDPR legislation or whatever is going to come down the pipe or is coming down the pipe right now that the rest of us are pretty much unaware of.
Yeah. But it's, again, the problem. It was very nice. Last term, we started discussing about how efficient SOMR is in communicating because there were some criticisms like, oh, SOMR is not communicating properly. The message is not getting right. So we created an audit of the different touch points that a member of SOMR, a non-member of SOMR can get from SOMR. And it's amazing. I mean, the amount of touch points that you can get from SOMR is impressive. But we live in a world in which attention is scarce, in a world that we are all impacted by so many messages that it's very difficult to get messages across. But yeah, if people could pay this attention to the important stuff, I can tell you that what SOMR is doing is very important.
So what is it that you're hoping to get done as president?
My motto is that I want to reinforce the bridges across practices and geographies. Okay, this would be a sentence to kind of compile everything. So I believe that macro research is in a very exciting moment. You are constantly talking about that. The digitization of our societies has brought a new approach to customer, consumer, citizen, whatever you might call it, understanding. So today we have an unparalleled access to understand what consumers do, think and feel. And as you were saying, everybody can research today. And on top of that, the end client or the purchaser of its research is living its own transformation in a very fast pace. So these needs are constantly evolving and require different responses. So now, as you were saying before, the traditional market research has seen the how the new market research or the digital and tech or technology related insights have appeared. So as professionals, we need to properly manage this digital transformation. We need to be smart enough to get the optimal symbiosis of traditional research, traditional practices, and those coming from the digital and analytics world. If you allow me, I always like to say that if at a certain stage SOMAR could be perceived as a country club, all members coming from the same background and status, I think that today SOMAR has to get closer to what I call the Star Wars intergalactic canteen. So a place populated by humans, humanoids, robots, all sorts of species that contribute to the understanding of humans. So this is regarding my bridge across practices. And my bridge across geographies is that, as we were talking at the beginning of this interview, the world is very big and there are many realities. And every single market is different. Indeed, in the US, it's not the same in the West Coast and the East Coast or the mid of the country. But there are common threads. Of course, there are common threads, but each market has its own peculiarities. And I can tell you, I've been traveling around the globe during these last years, and I have seen excellent practices across the globe. I've been attending the LATAM conference for the last 5 years, APAC for the last 8 years, I think. I've been in the US, in Europe, in some other countries. And there are excellent experiences. And I do believe that we have to learn one from the other and increase the awareness and elevate our profession. And lastly, I like to be global and to be local. And I believe that we need to reinforce the sense of community, the sense of belonging, not only as SOMAR, but also as insight professionals, as market research professionals. We need to have the sense of community because it is the way we can, all of us, adapt to the challenges that the digitalization of our societies is bringing.
It's going to be fun watching how this unfolds over the next 4 years. And I particularly like your connection with, I'll call it the middle class is not the right way of saying it, but it's basically this flattening of importance, whether, it's US or, pick the country, Nepal, right? Everybody has a voice. The voice is important, and we need to understand it so that we can create policy that helps give us a better view ultimately of the industry and helps empower the companies, the brands to make good decisions.
Yep. Yeah. And the market is very big, and there are opportunities everywhere.
So this podcast will have about 500, just over 500 insight professionals listen to it, hopefully more. Incidentally, if you haven't been sharing it, please take time to share it on social. All right. As you know, market researchers are full of opinions. I think it's pent up in us, by the way, because nobody asks our opinions as much as they do, right? We're relaying the opinions of the customer. What is one question you would like the listeners of this podcast, Insight Nations, to answer?
Okay, I try to be provocative. So my question would be, what is your personal contribution to improve, to elevate the status of our profession?
Perfect. I'll be when this goes live, we'll be posting this particular question on social. So I'm excited about seeing and the feedback. And then also it would be fun to write a little blog post. Maybe we'll co-author that addressing it. So my guest today has been Joaquin Brecha. Sir, thank you very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Thank you, Jamie. It's been my pleasure.
As always, I appreciate your time and listening. If you'd be willing, please leave us a review on whatever platform you're using. We would love it if you would share this podcast and let other insight professionals know about the great value of our guests. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Stay tuned for an HR tip from our previous guest, Mark Zients of Automated Insights.
Passion, agility, and accountability. So, you know, first, you got to love what you do. I mean, if you don't, it's a job. If you don't, you'll be there for a period of time. But if they think at the end of the day, you really have to love what it is you're doing. And by the way, that can extend to who you're working with, who you're working for, what is the culture. But the most, you know, basic building block of that aspect is, do you believe in the product? Do you believe in what the company does? Do you believe in the mission? I think people in our company get pretty excited about the fact that we help people understand their data. And they see that as a huge problem, and they see that as something creating value. So I think our people have passion around that because they think it's a big challenge, and it creates a tremendous amount of value. So that passion, I think, is just vital. The second one I mentioned was agility. And I spoke on this earlier. You know, if you don't like change, if you don't like having to zig instead of zag sometimes, if you think everything is going to go on your perfectly on your 3 to 5 year plan, good luck. That's not my experience. I'm always suspect when somebody tells me, this is my plan from the beginning, we did it perfectly, and this was our outcome. And I just smile and I'm polite. Because when I look back on everything, many times we ended up in great places, but it certainly wasn't a smooth road. There were bumps along the way. And then finally, accountability. I think it's accountability to yourself, accountability to your colleagues, accountability to your customers. And I think if you have people that are accountable, it also affords you great freedom. It's freedom for people to, you know, work remotely when they want to work remotely, or be working, you know, if they have something in the middle of the day with their kids and they're going to, you know, get their deliverable out that evening, it enables that to happen. You know, so, you know, you can have a trust-based organization when people are accountable.
For me, one of the most impactful parts of business is being passionate about adding value. And that value is added through the continuum of whatever it is that you're doing. If it's manufacturing, you could be on the line, but the value is the consistency and high quality of that work. Additionally, and I think even more impactfully, if you are, I mean, anybody inside of the company, applying your passion and care for the final delivery is going to resonate and drive a positive culture. And if there is a positive culture that exists, that exudes into the customer relationships. I remember early on with Rackspace, I was customer number 102, if you can believe that. And they launched with fanatical customer support. That word fanatical has gone through some iterations since that time. But in those days, the interpretation of fanatical was really like, this is what gets us out of bed in the morning, is making sure that you are absolutely taken care of. They weren't leading with, you know, best, fastest, reliable, etc. All those underpinnings are there from a messaging perspective, but the lead was fanatical customer support. And I think that starts from a customer journey perspective, not when you're talking with a salesperson, but it happens when the customer dials in or sends an email or fills out a web form or tries to find you online, right? So passion around what it is that you do, a love for that particular task, is absolutely critical. And as you deliver on that, your career will advance. I want to end on a brief story. One of my best friends, Bobby, he came from Romania and as a first generation, moved here when he was in seventh grade with his mother. after graduating from college, got a job working at a box plant, a corrugated box plant. He was working in the assembly line. From there, he had an opportunity to advance his career and start supporting the by doing janitorial work. That kind of gave him a little bit of a side hustle opportunity. And he just kicked butt and did a great job delivering on that part. He continued to advance, moved into accounting, eventually sales. And now he's the, if not one of the top salesmen on the West Coast for corrugated boxes, which is a truckload of money. In fact, he makes more money a year than I ever did outside of selling businesses. So, you know, the point is that if you are passionate about where you're putting your time and energy, then the byproduct, the outcome of what you generate, it will be just 10x what your peers, what other people are applying, and it will help propel you to the next thing. Thanks, everybody, for listening to today's episode of the Happy Market Research Podcast. An absolute privilege. We are honored that you would be willing to spend so much time with us. I hope you have a fantastic rest of your day. Please, please, please share this episode on the platform of your choice. If you would just tweet it or if you would take the time to post it on LinkedIn, it would mean the world to us. This episode is brought to you by G3 Translate. The G3 Translate team offers unparalleled expertise in foreign language translations for market researchers and insight professionals across the globe. Not only do they speak hundreds of languages, they are fluent in market research. For more information, please visit them at g3translate.com. That's the letter G, the number 3, translate.com.